Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor, Stone Payton here, our first episode of WeWork Radio, and I'm excited to be here. Stone, this is a cool venue and hustling, bustling, a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun, and it's great to get out of the studio, right?
I know.
Although it feels like we're in our studio. I mean, we've got the microphones, got everything going here. It's going to be cool.
Looking out the window, everything's good.
But we got snacks right behind us. We got espresso. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could throw a rock in any direction. You've got some sort of amenity here. I love it here.
Yep.
All right, let's go to work. Let's interview this gentleman.
All right. First up on WeWork Radio, we got Mike Cohn, and he is with Berkeley Development. How are you doing, Mike?
I'm doing great. Good morning. Welcome to WeWork.
I know. How long have you been here at WeWork?
I've been here for a little over 2 years, actually.
2 years. So what made you choose WeWork?
I was moving back to Atlanta and starting my own business in the middle of 2016. Had an office in my house, and I came down to go to work the first day in my house and asked my wife what she was doing that day, and she told me I needed to go find an office. So that was the beginning of my search for office space, and WeWork happened to just have opened its first facility in Atlanta, and I thought it was perfect for someone starting a business to be around people and to be in the heart of Buckhead,
right,
and not be in their basement of their house.
So now tell us about Berkeley. How are you serving folks?
Berkeley is a real estate investment and development company. I'm a career retail mixed-use real estate developer. I've served mostly large platforms throughout my career and was working on a big platform in Miami in late 2015, early 16, which I started in 2013. It was sold to a private equity firm a couple of years later. So my wife and I moved back to Atlanta, and I decided rather than associate with another large platform or to try and start another large platform, I wanted to start my own business. Started Berkeley, which is named for my daughter, Berkeley, and got some space at WeWork and have some capital partners in Florida and work as a sole proprietorship with support from other companies around the Southeast.
So now when you're saying platform, what does that mean? I'm not a real estate.
Platform is, we'll take a step back. You know, the retail platform is focused in the retail world. And so I was for many years associated with companies that owned, developed, managed, traded in large retail projects with full development, operating, management staffs.
So a project could be a strip center.
Could be a strip center.
Could be one of these live, work, play.
It could be a strip center. It could be a mixed-use deal with apartments or office over retail. It could be a project that had retail and hotel. Retail was always kind of the common theme.
So retail meaning
shopping.
Shopping and
yes.
Some
stores.
Whatever that means.
Stores, food,
right.
Experience, yes.
So now, is WeWork considered retail or is that different?
You know, WeWork would consider themselves having some retail components. And if you kind of read about WeWork, it's an interesting company. It started as co-working space, but it's really now getting into multiple brands of business, including residential and some retail. WeWork bought the old Lord & Taylor building in
right.
New York, as a matter of fact, for its headquarters. So there's some retail roots there. But retail and WeWork is now most recently talking about kind of operating stores out of their facility. So they know their business model better than I do, but I do know they are evolving into the retail space.
So now how did you get into retail?
I was a real estate lawyer by education and by practice for 5 years with a large firm here in Atlanta in the commercial real estate section. By commercial, meaning industrial, office, retail, not kind of non-residential functions of real estate. And after 5 years, I decided to leave private practice, and I went in-house at a traditional shopping center developer here in Atlanta.
And you were
initially as the in-house counsel, correct? And then after a couple of years, I transitioned to a business position.
So now, what was that like to transition from the legal side to the kind of, you know, now you're selling, you're doing other.
I don't know how many lawyers may be listening, but it's the equivalent of getting out of jail.
Really?
Yeah.
So
for me, it was.
It was like you were in a box kind of with the legal side of it?
To some extent, very, very early in my legal career, I would go to meetings or closings, and lawyers would just be banging the crap out of each other, and the clients would kind of be sitting off on the side, sometimes getting into the fray, but more often than not, kind of acting as referee, and then And then at the end of the day, the lawyers would go try and document what the clients had agreed upon, and the clients would go for a drink with each other. And this actually seemed to like each other. And there, right. there seemed to be a relationship that actually transcended whatever provisions there were in a document.
Right.
And so very early in my career, I thought to myself, I'd rather be one of those guys. And so ultimately, I worked my way to that.
So now when you're on that side of the table, how does the lawyering inform the way you're dealing in relationships?
I'm sorry. I'm not sure follow the question.
So you're a lawyer first. Yes. And then so the way that you look at a deal or something is through that lens. So now you're the deal maker, but you still have all this lawyer knowledge.
That's a great question. I think particularly for real estate, I think it's a terrific training to understand how deals are structured.
And where the landmines are, right?
And where the landmines are and how to protect against landmines. So it's one of a number of disciplines you can bring to the table in trying to create a better situation on the real estate side. The financial background, understanding leasing, and then the legal piece of it. As much as I like to kid around about not enjoying the actual practice of law, day to day, there's not a day that goes by that I don't use some piece of it
right.
in the deal making.
And then on your website, it's interesting. It says Berkley is an independent Atlanta-based real estate investment and advisory firm founded on the career and business philosophies of founder Mike Cohn. So what are these business philosophies that are so important to you that you headline your website?
Well, sometimes you have to rely on your branding on your branding folks for their text. But you know, I think over the course of my career, I've been very fortunate. I've worked for some really iconic figures in the real estate industry. I started my real estate career with at Newmarket Development with Dean Dupree, who was Newmarket then was the preeminent power center developer in the country. That company was acquired by Cousins, so I got to work for Tom Cousins for many years. I left Cousins and was Henry Faison, which if real estate folks will know the name, it was kind of the Charlotte version of Tom Cousins. And then I went to Lennar, started a business for Lennar, and worked for Stuart Miller. And all four of those guys are iconic guys and truly, you know, kind of giants in their respective fields. And the principles that I've kind of put together as my own over the years are the things I've taken from them along the way about integrity, honesty, doing things the right way, communicating, treating your landowner as a partner, even though you're just trying to buy land from them, how you respect other people inside and outside of your organization. So it's really, I wish I could claim a lot of it as original, but it's probably mostly what I've really learned and cobbled together from some terrific mentors over the years.
So the best practices.
Best practices from the best people. And
so now what are some of the projects you're working on?
I can be a little communicative about that. Some of the stuff hasn't been announced yet.
Sure. Just maybe some of the things you have recently worked on.
So some of the things we've recently worked on, I can tell you, at Berkley, which is a little over a year old in its current iteration, we just started a reasonably large project in Macon, Georgia, which is an old-fashioned, you know, freeway-oriented, single-level power center with Marshall's, Home Goods, Michael's, Old Navy, kind of retail names that, mm-hmm. that everybody knows. Prior to that, we did downtown, the retail portion of downtown Doral in Doral, Florida, in Miami, Florida. The shops at Carolina Reserve, which is a large power center outside of Charlotte.
When you're doing these, are they don't exist and you're building them from
they
the
either don't
up?
Exist and we're building them from the ground up, or is there's a lesser use on the land and we're redeploying land to a higher and better use.
Mm-hmm. And then so do you have a preference, or it's just the opportunity, whatever is the best opportunity?
You know, the developer in me says the preference is whatever is the most profitable, but it's not that simple. I like the intellectual challenge. I tend to like redevelopment better. Putting together a more difficult mousetrap mm-hmm. takes longer. It's more sophisticated. You typically need help from more external sources than you do just kind of ground up suburban development. But more than anything, I like a mix of things, so I'm not working on one thing. Deal fatigue in real estate can be detrimental to what you're doing right. every day, and so I try and keep things mixed and varied, so I stay interested in everything that I'm doing.
So now, what kind of trends are you seeing in the marketplace? Like, it seems to me, a layperson in this, there's a lot of this live work play. You know, they're trying to make these multi-use opportunities there, even to the point where the government, like I live in Sandy Springs. So Sandy Springs has their city hall and there's a yoga studio adjacent and there's a park area.
Correct.
And so is that a trend?
You know, I live in Sandy Springs as well. So we just had dinner two nights ago at the project that you're talking about, and I think what's
at Flower Child
that's right, along with every other person. Right. There's a free plug for Flower Child. Right. You can't get in Flower Child. I know, it's great, it's great food. But the interesting thing about your question, and we'll use Sandy Springs as an example, even though it's very local to us, is not what it is today solely, but what it used to be.
Right.
It's an old Target store.
Right, and a Goodwill.
And a Goodwill, which prior to the Goodwill was a grocery store that Harris Teeter that pulled out of Atlanta. So to some extent, the project is a reflection of what retail always is, which is retail's always changed. There's always winners and losers in retail. And if you go back to, 50 years ago when the suburban mall expansion was happening, even then there were still winners and losers in retail and stores that kind of populate and backfill other failed stores. What's really happened today is a function of a number of things, not just retailers succeeding or failing, but an entire demographic and psychographic change in the U.S., demographic change in terms of people wanting to be more urban, people wanting to use more mass transit. The millennial and Gen Z generation, which you'll hear more about Gen Z in years to come. It's the generation behind millennials. If you had to ask them one word that they would use to describe what they like, it's authenticity. It's fairly hard to create an authentic experience. Right. on a subway, on a freeway, on an off-ramp with a big parking lot. So whether the projects are small or large today, I think what people are looking for authentic, and if that could involve one use or a mix of uses.
Now, what about the trend of online shopping and how that impacts? Is that we've interviewed a lot of people that are involved in e-commerce and things like that, and with Amazon, and that's a big. It seems like they suck a lot of the oxygen out of the room.
Who's Amazon?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I think they just announced a big headquarters or
right.
two.
But they still more shopping happens in person, right?
Nine out of every plus or minus, and depending on how you do the math, 9 out of every $10 that are spent on shopping are still generally done in a store. Yes.
Right. Even though that Amazon gets all the headlines. No, the people are still going to the stores.
People are still going to the store. What people want in their stores, I think, is changing. 10 years ago, what you wanted in the store was everything. Today, the store is really, even though 90% of sales occur in stores, the store is really the facilitator of an experience. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people, and if you pick up, probably from 2014 to 2017, if you picked up the Wall Street Journal, I think they were paying staff writers at the Journal to write articles that had dead mall in the headline. It was kind of a Where's Waldo kind of thing.
Right.
And the retail apocalypse and whatever descriptor you wanted, it's really more of a retail. There's really more of a retail renaissance going on. I think. I think it's retail's never been more exciting because of all of the different ways you can shop. And I think what customers and retailers are kind of concluding as we get to the next stage together is that these are not competitive events. They're all online, catalog, showrooms, store experiences. They're all one brand, and the retailers who are more successful are falling one of two buckets. One, the ones who provide the overall experience better. Best Buy is a great example for that now. A store that was dead in the water 5 years ago because of showrooming now runs the best showroom in the country, effectively. Or the stores that you don't have an online experience on because there's a bit of a treasure trove. You never know what's going to be there, like a TJ Maxx or a Costco.
Right.
So counterintuitive to anything you would think, right? Stores without a web presence are doing well because it's the experience of the surprise that keeps drawing people in. So,
and then when you're developing something, is there any kind of coaching that comes in play from you, like your opinion on how they should, I don't want to say do business, but just kind of take advantage of that experience-driven kind of economy that we're in now?
I think the next retailer that accepts coaching from a developer will probably be the first retailer.
What's that relationship work like? That you're just the one that's putting these deals together?
It depends on the kind of the nature and the format of what you're doing. If you're talking about a deal like Sandy Springs Town Center, right, whatever the gateway,
or
whatever,
like the Battery,
or the Battery. I mean, there's a lot of collaboration that goes on because it's not just the stores that are there. It's the nature of the experience that you have when you're there. It's what does it feel like when you get to the parking deck? What amenities are there? Is it, you know, it's retail for the first time in a very long time beyond kind of the information booth at the mall has a very hospitality-driven component because that's what's getting people out of their homes and into an experiential playground, not just the ability to buy another blue shirt. We can all buy that blue shirt online, or 10 of them.
And then not only that, you want them to come back. Like, it's not, you just don't want them to come there once.
Well, you really don't want them to leave.
That's optimal.
So that's right. So
that's why
living above it. There's offices, there's apartments, there's, you know, there are hotels. So it's really about, two things. And you touched on one of the two things that's so important. One is extending the stay, right? I mean, if you have entertainment and experience, a movie theater, a good restaurant, terrific shopping, there's something for everybody. So the family can spend an entire day rather than just to go to Michael's or Hobby Lobby, buy an easel, and then leave and go back home. So it's about extending the day, and then it's also about creating additional days.
And then, so what do you think of like the Battery? Is that a model that you think other stadiums are going to follow?
I think other stadiums have followed it. I think the great thing about development today is we're all learning from each other. So if you go to Petco Park in San Diego or Camden Yards in Baltimore, those were early versions of what the Battery is today. And both of those are a little more urban. I think the surprising thing about the Battery, frankly, is that it's been as successful as it is in essentially a suburban location, you know, kind of cut off from foot traffic by two freeways.
Right.
So I guess I don't mind saying it on air, a little bit to my surprise, it's been more successful than I would have expected it to be. I thought it would be a traffic nightmare. You know, living in Sandy Springs, I thought I'd never be able to get out of my neighborhood on game day. None of that's really come to pass. Actually, very easy to get to. And then you peel back the layer of the onion a little bit, and you look at the nature of the stores that are at the Battery. Bless you. And it's what you would expect. There's not a lot of fashion. You're not going to go to the Battery to do your Christmas shopping or to buy an anniversary gift. You're going to go to the Battery to watch a ball game and to be entertained. There's apartments there, so there's 24/7 activity. The office component has been very successful.
The Omni just opened,
and Comcast is there. So it's true. It's truly live, work, play, kind of a 24/7 experience. But the nature of the retail there is more entertainment driven, food driven, experience driven than it is apparel driven.
And it's less kind of chains and more like for food, at least they're kind of more boutique-y restaurants.
Yeah, I can't remember the last person who I've heard say I want to open a chain restaurant. You know, chain restaurants are kind of becoming dinosaurs to some extent. You know, brands are extending, but the true chain restaurant has really fallen into disfavor. And kind of the question I like to ask, now that we have great restaurants, you go to every city in America, there's great restaurants. 50,000 population cities have great restaurants. New York has great restaurants. And what I sit there and what my wife and I joke about is where were all these chefs hiding for all these years? Were they stuck behind the bowl of pasta at Olive Garden because that's what happens when you get out of culinary school? So what really has happened is as life is driven by capital, a lot of capital has flowed into the restaurant business because people who provide that capital, developers and real estate owners, have figured out that your collection of restaurants is every bit as much an anchor tenant for your project as who your hard goods and soft goods or department stores are.
So now that strategy has shifted from a developer standpoint? Like maybe at one point in your career, you were looking at the grocery store anchor or something like that, and now you're looking for a sprinkling of chef driven or more boutique?
There's a lot to that. I think, there are some chefs who are so preeminent around the country, like a Wolfgang Puck, just to pick a name kind of that everybody knows, that they alone can be an anchor. In Atlanta, you know, Ford Fry maybe getting to that place right. locally.
Kevin Gillespie, but
typically in a bigger project, it's the collection of restaurants that acts as an anchor. So what you can effectively do, so long as you can get in once you get there, is to say, instead of saying, let's go to restaurant X tonight, and it's hit or miss whether or not you can get into restaurant right. X. Let's go. What you say instead is, let's go to project Y, and we have a choice of six different restaurants, right. and then we'll figure it out once we get there. The hardest part about being a retailer and owning a shopping center is what? It's getting people to your shopping center. That's the part you don't necessarily control, and that's so if you can do that, you've already won. And if you look at projects like Avalon, Krog Street, the Battery, I mean, that's what those are doing best, is just getting people to come and say, you know, once I get there, I'll figure it out, but it feels good when I'm there, so I'm going to enjoy the different parts of it.
So now, as a developer, are you kind of like the curator, or you're trying, because in your head,
you have to fill the spots, you got to curate a mix. So for large parts of retail development over the past 8 or 10 years, kind of that old hard good, soft good tenanting model, which was what we did for decades with the enclosed malls and open-air lifestyle centers and power centers, has been replaced with, I'll use the word you just used, even though it's a little bit overused, it's a much more carefully curated selection to choose from. It's foods and specialty foods, like the grocer that you mentioned. It's health and wellness, you know, yoga, Pilates, Pure Bar, home services for folks, and then and food. And those are really the kind of the four components of what's driving shopping today, are those four components.
So now when you take on a project, do you talk to those people first? Do you say, okay, let me get some restaurants on board about this opportunity? Like, what's the chicken and the egg?
Well, every project is different and every site is different. So what you really try and do first is, if you find a site that you like, try and figure out what's best for that site. And so you'll have kind of an A target list of prospects and a B target list, and kind of work through. And sometimes you get one from column A and one from column B. Not every site is appropriate for every form of
sure.
development. So if you're in town, if you're at Ponce de Leon and Peachtree, you're going vertical, and you're going very vertical, and you're probably going to have a lot of residential or office or a hotel with some amenities on the ground floor. If you're at I-75 and Bass Road in Macon, you're probably going to be single level surface parking. The rents don't drive the vertical construction kind mm-hmm. of thing. So that there's a little bit of science to it and a little bit of art to it.
And then what's the most rewarding part of the job for you?
You know, it's an interesting question. The deeper I get into my career, the most rewarding part of the job to me accelerates to the front end of the process. It used to be waiting until the project opened and seeing people there and be vibrant, which has become anywhere in retail and mixed use development a 5 to 7 year process.
Right.
So it's still rewarding, but by then you're so exhausted on any given project, or you've already moved on to two other projects right. while that one's being built. So really, the most exciting thing for me today in my career, other than the capital event that comes at the end of the whole process, is really putting the mousetrap together in the first place.
It's that blank sheet of paper.
It's the blank sheets, figuring out what to put on the blank sheet of paper, and then once that's been figured out, in a lot of ways, I feel like, well, kind of my role's been done. The execution team can take it from there. Not that it's not important. There's
sure.
a lot of money to be made or lost, but there are people who are much better at that mm-hmm. than I am, and then I can hopefully move on to find the next blank sheet of paper. And the biggest worry, what keeps you up at night is, you know, wondering when do you get to a point where you can't find that next blank sheet of paper.
Now, what do you need more of? How can we help you?
What do we need? We can always, I think I can speak on behalf of virtually every retail developer and owner when I say we need more tenants. The world of tenants has shrunk over the past 10 years after the Great Recession. You know, going into the Great Recession, putting aside restaurants and entrepreneurs who ran smaller chains, we had the great fortune of living in a world, certainly on the big box side of development, where there were 2, 3, 4 decent to very good competitors in every category.
Right.
Probably shouldn't have been, but there were. And now you fast forward 10 years, and for the combination of overexpansion and then the crushing recession and the change in retail experience and the change in shopping habits, we now have categories that barely have one player in it anymore. Like, use the electronic category. Mm-hmm. There was Circuit City, there was Leechmere. Right. If you remember Leechmere, they were here. There was, Incredible Universe and all of these. And now there's Best Buy.
Right.
I hate to use names on TV because or radio. I don't want to mean to insult anybody, but we're shrinking retailers, and retailer stores have also shrunk and gotten smaller. But that's not the bigger issue that we face. The biggest issue we face is there's just not as many retailers as there used to be.
But there's still entrepreneurs that have dreams and they're taking shots, but they're less kind of reliably financially consistent for
you? Well, I think the retail world has changed. I think you could do a whole section on what is credit retail. I've been in the business for 25 years and I'm not quite sure what credit retail means anymore. I've gotten to the place where I would almost, you mentioned Kevin Gillespie earlier or, Rathbun, or I almost to make a good case that that's a safer bet than someone,
really?
than someone, because they're so good at what they do and they have a built-in following and a track record, that's a better anchor than possibly a credit retailer who might get killed by the internet in 2 years or by driverless cars or by some other form of technology that doesn't exist anymore. When last time I checked, there's only one way to eat, and it's to put your put your food on a fork and open your mouth, and I don't think that's changing anytime soon.
So. And if somebody wanted to learn more and have a more substantive conversation, even though this was pretty substantive conversation, where should they go? Website for you guys?
Website is www.berkeleydevelopment.us. It's Berkeley, Berkeley, development spelled traditionally, .us.
Good stuff, Mike. Thank you so much for sharing your story today.
Thanks for having me.
All right. This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We will see you all next time on WeWork Radio.